This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello everyone, welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 158, A Flawed Inheritance. Once again, I just want to remind everyone that I will be presenting at Intelligent Speech Online as one of the keynote speakers on February 28th, 2026. As if that wasn't enough 20s for you, early bird tickets are currently available for $20, but you can get that price reduced even further using my promo code PERSIA. Go to intelligentspeechonline.com and get your tickets today. I really hope to see you all in February. Back to this episode, though. Alright, everybody, it is family episode time. Let's not sugarcoat it. Seleucus II Callinicus, a man whose beautifully triumphant epithet gets more ironic with every passing sentence, is on his way to the chopping block. But first, as always, we need to talk about his family, and there's a lot going on here. There are stories yet to be discussed, but a lot of them are about royal relatives, so they go here. Last time, everything fell apart. Seleucus II, fresh off a surprise turnaround series of victories in Syria and Phoenicia, had to end his offensive against Ptolemy III and go to war with his younger brother, Antiochus Hyrax. Hyrax successfully pushed Seleucus out of Anatolia at the Battle of Ancyra, tried to set himself up as an independent king, and was immediately chased out of the region himself by a surprise onslaught from the newly crowned King Attalus I of Pergamon. Ultimately, Hyrax went on to an ignoble death, murdered by Gallic bandits while trying to flee as an exile in Thrace. Meanwhile, Seleucus faced off with a series of revolts or riots in Babylon and marched to war against a new force in the east, King Arsaces, a Saka warlord who had made himself an independent kingdom in the former Seleucid provinces of Parthia and Hyrcania. Simultaneously, Bactria struck for full independence, and King Diodotus II fully embraced the royal titles too, founding the Greco-Bactrian kingdom. Seleucus Callinicus was repelled from the region entirely by Arsaces, but there's a decent chance the only Iranian territories he had left were Media, and not even all of Media, since the kingdom of Atropatene was just quietly doing its own thing outside the scope of written history. On to the family, we are kicking things off with the Queen Mother. Whatever happened to Laodike I, right? She was a major player at the start of Seleucus' reign in 242, but kind of faded out of the picture once the civil war got started. She is even considered one of the people who started this series of conflicts in the first place. Frankly, we don't really know what happened to her. She'd be about 60 at this point in the narrative, so it's completely reasonable that she could have died of natural causes or some sort of illness. It is the 3rd century BCE, and we're fresh out of those good old Achaemenid genes that made everybody live into their 90s. There are a few references to the possibility that she was captured and killed by Ptolemaic forces, but it's not all that clear when it would have happened. We know she was based in Ephesus early on, but she also seems to have been active in the years after Ptolemy conquered that city. It's also a bit odd that he would have a queen mother killed. It could have been retaliation for the death of his sister, Berenike, but Laodike's safety would have been a powerful bargaining chip in the Third Syrian War. Ultimately, we just don't know. Laodike I just seems to have died at some point before Attalus chased the Seleucids out of Anatolia entirely. Her siblings are another story altogether. The second Laodike of the family, usually portrayed as a sister but possibly a niece, married Seleucus II, so she's on hold for the moment. Laodike I's other sister, Antiochus, can get her own coverage. Based on the politics of this period, if Antiochus was alive when Seleucus came to power, I would have to guess she died early on, because she was married to Attalus, the brother of Eumenes, tyrant of Pergamon. And if you can keep that family tree straight in your head, despite all of the peoples involved doing their best to curb it back on itself, then you already know that makes Antiochus the mother of King Attalus I, situating Attalus as a first cousin to the warring Seleucid brothers. I'm guessing Antiochus was dead, or at least had very minimal influence over her son. But who knows? Maybe she wholeheartedly supported Attalus chasing the rest of her family out of Anatolia. Their brother, Alexander, satrap of Lydia, also goes missing in the shuffle of poorly documented information following the civil war and the Pergamene invasion. He was Antiochus Hyrax's most important supporter up to that point, but his story is lost. It's entirely possible that Sardis did fall to Attalus at some point, but it's odd that the king of Pergamon wouldn't celebrate that on his victory inscription. It's also possible that Alexander led Hyrax's forces in one of the other battles against Attalus and died in combat, which may explain why there wasn't more of a notable victory at Sardis. The city would have been left undefended. From that part of the family, we are just left with Andromachus. Unlike his siblings, Andromachus did not remain in Anatolia when Seleucus went to war with Ptolemy. He may even have already been in Syria before the war started, because he was taken captive by Ptolemy III and sent to Egypt. He may also have been exchanged as a hostage to secure the peace between the Seleucids and Egypt when the civil war with Hyrax started. The first few years of captivity in Egypt were fairly quiet, but we will come back to this Andromachus at a later date. We are pretty sure that this Andromachus had at least one child as well, but there is room for confusion here, and I promise this is the last time I'll tear apart this particular branch of the Seleucid family tree. The child we definitely know existed was a son named Achaios, who is a young man at this point in the story. But there are actually two Andromachoi at play in this time, and it is hard to say which is which, especially considering that they were probably father and son. One of them, the father, was taken captive by Ptolemy III or exchanged as a hostage. The other continued to fight in Seleucus's army as a general and joined Achaios as co-commander in the final battle against Hyrax in Mesopotamia. Achaios was definitely the son of whichever Andromachus went to Egypt. However, if it was the younger Andromachus in Egypt and the older Andromachus was just old and still commanding troops, it does explain another discrepancy in the family tree. Queen Laodike II, wife of Seleucus II, is stated by Polybius to be the sister of Andromachus, the father of Achaios. Many modern writers just assume this means the older Andromachus, but that would be a very unusual way for Polybius to identify her, given that all of the other siblings in that branch of the family, and their father, were notable historical figures. However, if the Andromachus in Egypt was not a royal uncle, but rather a generation younger, the names of the siblings, their relative ages, and the level of activity over time all start to make more sense. It even accounts for the presence of a second Andromachus in Mesopotamia. Ironically, a version of this idea actually seems to have circulated among a few historians almost 150 years ago, without accounting for the second Andromachus either, leading to the theory's abandonment. Speculation aside, we can finally move on to the other side of the family. Antiochus II Theos had one sister, aka aunt to Callinicus and Hyrax, who does come back into the story. Stratonike of Macedon, who had been sent by her brother to marry then Antigonid Prince Demetrius. That couple had a daughter, Apama, but Demetrius took other wives and Stratonike could hardly stand him to begin with. Their personal dynamics here must have been intense, because when Stratonike left her husband, she was not able to take her daughter with her. Stratonike arrived in Antioch around the same time as her nephew Seleucus, fresh off of his defeat at Ancyra. Stratonike tried to convince Seleucus to turn around and declare war on Demetrius instead of going east to avenge whatever personal insult she felt. Roman authors chalk this up to Demetrius's polygamy, but that wasn't unusual for Hellenistic kings, especially the Antigonids. According to Justin, she even tried to convince Seleucus to marry her himself as a casus belli, but the king opted to steer clear of that particular political entanglement. Stratonike or no, the Seleucids and Antigonids were still allies. So instead, while Seleucus was away, Stratonike lashed out by stoking a revolt in Antioch itself. It's highly unlikely that any rebel sentiment in the Syrian capital district was motivated by Stratonike, a princess they hadn't seen in decades, with a personal grudge and little else to her name. More likely, it was a tax revolt. Almost 20 straight years of constant fighting, plus the Ptolemaic occupation carrying off everything that wasn't nailed down, put a lot of pressure on the major cities that Seleucus still controlled. Stratonike just tried to attach herself to this revolt in order to pressure her nephew. Instead of giving in, after settling his affairs in Babylon, Seleucus returned furious, besieged the city's citadel, took Stratonike prisoner, and executed her for her role in the rebellion. with that, Seleucus's elders are out of the way, so we can move on to his siblings. Let's get the obvious out of the way. His brother was Antiochus Hyrax, you know that. We just did an episode all about how they kept trying to kill and steal from one another. Despite officially having three wives by the time he died, Hyrax did not have any children. And we don't actually know any of his wives' names. They are just the daughters of Ariamenes in Cappadocia, Mithridates II from Pontus, and the daughter of Zeilus from Bithynia. That said, if I had to hazard a guess, Mithridates' daughter was at least called Laodike, because both of his other daughters were named that. It's not quite as weird as it sounds. The Hellenistic period is full of double names for everyone who wasn't ethnically Greek or Macedonian to begin with. It was very common from Egypt to Iran for people to have their personal name fitting their native language and a legal Greek name for dealing with the government. The royal family of Pontus were Iranians, distant descendants of the Achaemenids, and so their names were Iranian. When they married Hellenistic rulers, they often took Hellenistic names to match. We don't know what circumstances led Hyrax and probably Laodike to not have any children, but just based on the timeline of succession, we can probably guess that his marriage to Zeilus's daughter was more of a political engagement than an actual wedding. The girl would still have been a child at the time, engaged to Hyrax politically, but probably not conceiving. That wasn't an unheard-of arrangement in pre-modern political marriages, at any rate. From there, we move on to their sisters. There was not a whole lot to say here. Seleucus's sister Laodike married Mithridates II, basically as the other end of the marriage pact with Hyrax. Like I mentioned a minute ago, Laodike and Mithridates apparently had two daughters, both of whom were at least eventually called Laodike. In the grand tradition of Pontic kings, they also had a son named Mithridates. The family was not exactly fueled by creative naming decisions. Through some political machinations we don't fully understand, the younger of these two Laodikes was actually fostered by another noble family in Pisidia, just east of Caria on the far side of the peninsula. This, too, was a fairly common political arrangement to foster alliances. Also, purely because he will never come up again, the son of Mithridates II probably did go on to be Mithridates III. We know effectively nothing about him besides that. Another of the royal sisters at this time, Stratonike, became queen of Cappadocia by marrying King Ariarathes III. Cappadocia is very obscure in this period, so all we can really say is they also had a son named Ariarathes, who went on to be king. The third sister in Seleucus and Antiochus Hyrax's generation was named Apama, and as I've said before, we only know that she existed because of one reference to her in Babylon. That brings us to Seleucus II's own immediate family. We know he did have multiple partners, thanks to Polyaenus's story of Mista, the royal concubine temporarily enslaved after the Battle of Ancyra. However, we only have references to one official wife. This was probably intentional. Two of Hyrax's political marriages came before this revolt, and it seems that Antiochus Theos and Laodike may have intentionally arranged political marriages for their younger son while only matching Seleucus with one partner to avoid the exact sort of dynastic schism that Antiochus Theos' own polygamy produced. So the only queen for the moment is Laodike II. of some sort of debatable parentage, but at least a cousin to the royal family. Unfortunately for this episode, that's basically all we know about her. Information for Seleucus II's reign is sparse to begin with. Even major wars barely rate a mention. So if Laodike wasn't directly involving herself in very dramatic political events, it's no surprise she is not well documented. And that just leaves us with Seleucus and Laodike's three known children. A daughter named Antiochus, and two sons, Alexander and Antiochus. I suspect that Antiochus was the youngest, given that we know very little about her other than her later marriage arrangement, and that didn't come until 212 BC. Alexander was the oldest, born shortly before Seleucus II came to the throne. We don't know much about him during his father's reign either, unsurprising given that he was born around the same time that the Third Syrian War started. By the time Seleucus marched off to fight Hyrax, Alexander was at least old enough to reliably survive into adulthood, but he was still just 15 or 16 years old when his father returned from the war in Parthia. Antiochus, the son of Seleucus, was a couple of years younger, and likewise, we know nothing about his adolescence. Given their relative youth, it's no surprise that neither of them were married yet, let alone having children. And with that, I'm out of family members to talk about, so we're going to go back to the narrative for a very short but eventful second half of the episode. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. Now we can return to the narrative properly. Seleucus II Callinicus returned from a defeat in Parthia and a revolt in Babylon. Along the way, the generals Achaios and Andromachus defeated Hyrax in one last battle, driving the rebel prince out of the empire and toward his death in Thrace. When Seleucus returned home, he defeated another rebellion in Antioch and executed Aunt Stratonike for her participation in the uprising. After so many defeats and troubles, he turned his sights on the last major enemy he had yet to personally fight, Attalus of Pergamon. The Seleucid Empire was on its last legs, and if he couldn't get Anatolia and its valuable ports and farmland and heavily urbanized cities back, there was a good chance that the empire might not be able to support itself against another invasion, either from one of the many breakaway kingdoms or Ptolemaic Egypt. So, from 228 to 225, Seleucus prepared his armies for another campaign into Anatolia. Then, in 225 BCE, he fell off his horse and died. The details aren't clear. Maybe he cracked his skull, maybe a broken bone got infected. Who knows? Either way, Seleucus Callinicus, the beautifully triumphant, although, in the end, maybe his original title of the Bearded was more appropriate, had been Basileus the King for just over 21 years. That left 20-year-old Alexander to assume the throne. But the young new king must have recognized the hubris in trying to claim the throne with his birth name and chose to use a regnal name instead, undergoing coronation at Antioch as King Seleucus III. The army had apparently already taken to calling him Keraunos, the Thunderbolt, which is one of our first repeat epithets. Keraunos was used to describe all sorts of behaviors, from rash impatience to general dynamism. Why they called Seleucus III that, we'll probably never know for sure. It quite literally might be because they needed a way to tell him apart from all of the other Seleucuses and Alexanders in their midst. I cannot stress enough how bad a moment in time this was to be a new king, especially a young new king. An empire barely holding on to its last fragments of stability, wants confident, experienced leadership, and a backup plan. For all his failings, Seleucus II had effectively beaten the odds, won back Syria when the empire was mostly on his side, and now that all of the fires were managed, he seemed to be planning to retake Anatolia and avenge the slights committed by Attalus. He was rebuilding his core base of financial and military support. Seleucus II had not one, but two sons old enough to replace him, at least with a short regency in Antiochus's case. Seleucus III had none of that. In fact, with a younger brother to leave behind in the capital, many nobles may have worried that Seleucus III and Antiochus were just on track to repeat the failures of their father's generation. So the new king opted to move forward with his father's plans, at least acting like everything could still work. He at least decided to proceed with caution. Seleucus split his army into three branches, with the first two seemingly moving ahead of his own column. These two forces were commanded by Epigenes and Lysias. Based on other possible references to these two, they were powerful nobles, with Epigenes based in the Seleucia district in Syria, and Lysias probably representing a loyalist faction that had remained in Anatolia during the Pergamene conquest. Seleucus and Achaios, the same general I referenced as a possible royal cousin, led the third column together. Here's the thing. We only know about Lysias's column due to a line on Attalus's victory inscription at Pergamon. And though that line is damaged, it also references a victory over a Seleucid general whose name started with Epsilon, aka the English letter E, as in Epigenes. The invasion launched in 224, and by the summer of 223, Lysias had already been defeated by Attalus. News of Epigenes' defeat that summer was apparently the final straw. A Galatian mercenary commander named Apaturios and a Seleucid officer named Nicanor conspired together in Seleucus III's war camp to slip some poison into the king's food one night, and by morning, Seleucus III was called Keranaus, the Thunderbolt. He had been Basileus, the king, of a dying empire for less than 3 years. Just long enough for his younger brother Antiochus to officially assume the throne under his own power. But that is a story we will put on hold for a few episodes. We have a lot of other topics to cover. So until next time, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.